Maybe you shop for wine on a regular basis, and even if you know exactly what you want, you have to be impressed by all the places that provide wine to the world. You can find it in stores sorted by country and by state, and around here anyway, there's usually a big rack of Oregon wine. Oregon wine has become a bigger deal in recent years, winning good reviews and awards, and a lot of land in our region once planted in fruit trees is now planted in grapevines. It might not be the first time. The extensive story of wine in Oregon is explored by Scott Stursa in the book Oregon Wine, A Deep-Rooted History. Scott Stursa spent 38 years in the information technology business before retiring and turning his full attention to writing. He works in fiction and nonfiction with several projects in the work. His first book is called Distilled in Oregon. Scott Stursa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I sense a trend in your subject matter from Distilled in Oregon to Oregon wine.
Yeah, I don't read too much into that because I'm mostly going to be working on fiction from this point on.
Mm-hmm.
I have been asked whether or not I'm going to write a trilogy here with a book on history of beer making in the state. But the problem there is that beer drinkers are not a big book buying demographic. So I don't think that's ever going to happen.
I think you just dissed a bunch of beer drinkers.
What's that?
I think you just dissed a bunch of beer drinkers.
I hope not. I drink a lot of beer myself.
All right. Well, you're a writer and a reader as well. And talk about the experience that really kind of kindled your interest in wine. You talked about a real difference you noticed when you first had a truly quality wine.
Well, it's one of those revelatory experiences. Most people have had them with a number of things. I grew up in a household where the coffee that was made in the morning was instant, and so I thought I didn't like coffee. And then one day in college, I was visiting a friend who was very much into coffee, and she was brewing up some, I think it was some Sumatran coffee of some type. And I tried that and realized, wow, coffee is actually pretty good. So I had similar experiences with a number of things, including wine.
Did you move to Oregon because of the wine?
No.
Okay. Now, speaking of moving, a wine from Oregon and native grape species, what do we have here? Is it from native grape species? Is it imported? Is it a mix?
Well, most of what's grown in the state, most of what's grown in the United States for wine production is the European grapevine, Vitis vinifera. There are some wines being grown in the central and eastern part of the United States that are based on hybrid varieties, crossings of Vitis vinifera with native species such as Vitis labrusca, Vitis riparia, and so forth. And those hybrids were created both to make the grape less susceptible to parasitic diseases like phylloxera, and also make them a little more cold weather tolerant.
All right. So what they're doing is they're trying to make a hardier species in a couple different ways.
Yeah. But most of what's being grown for wine production in Oregon, I'd say 99% is Vitis vinifera. There are some people growing a grape called Marechal Foch, which is a hybrid. There are some people growing Cayuga, which is also a hybrid, actually down there in southern Oregon. Girardet Winery is making quite a bit of Cayuga, and I haven't had it myself, but apparently it's pretty good because they sell out every year.
Well, you take on a number of myths about Oregon winemaking in here, including the oft-repeated origin story of Oregon wine. What is that origin story, and what did you find out?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean specifically by the origin story. I mean, there's several levels of myth. There's sort of the basic myth that there was absolutely no wine production in the state, at least grape wine production in the state prior to the 1960s, and that's absolutely not true. Typical origin story that most people are referring to is the origin of Pinot Noir, which is unquestionably the signature grape of Oregon wine production. And traditionally, it's been believed that that wasn't brought in until the 1960s, with Richard Sommer initially growing it in the early 60s in the Umpqua Valley, and then David Lett and Charles Curry introducing it to the Willamette Valley in the late 60s. And in fact, there's a pretty good case in the historical record for at least three individuals, one in Jackson County and two in the Willamette Valley, growing it prior to Prohibition.
So, and one of those is the Frenchman Jean Mathieu?
No, Jean did not grow Pinot Noir.
Oh.
He probably wanted to. He went down after clearing his land in the late 1850s for a vineyard. He went down to the San Francisco area to buy grapevines. And the region of France he came from, the primary grapes that were being grown there, he was from Franche-Comte, which is a little slice of France in between Burgundy and Switzerland. And most of the grapes grown there are Pinot Noir, Pulsard, which is a red Swiss grape, and Chardonnay. And that's probably what he wanted to buy. But he got down there and started going to the various nurseries down there that were selling European grapevines. There were several of them. And they didn't have any of those. Pinot Noir didn't come in until 1862. Pulsard didn't come in until the 1870s. And Chardonnay didn't come in until the 1880s. So he ended up buying grapevines from other varieties that were grown in Western France and Eastern France and Western Germany.
We are learning a lot about the history of Oregon wine, which goes back perhaps a bit further than you thought. It certainly predates Pinot Noir and 1961, as Scott Stursa points out early in his book, Oregon Wine, A Deep-Rooted History. You can join our conversation about the wine industry and its history in Oregon, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Jean Mathieu in the Willamette Valley in the early days of white settlement. Going to the Bay Area to get some vine stock to create his own vineyards, and wasn't finding the stuff he wanted. What did he bring back then, Scott?
Well, it's been reported by Adam Shipley, who was sort of the foremost viticulturist in Oregon in the late 1800s, that there were 50 varieties of grapes being grown in the Mathiot vineyard. Unfortunately, I've never found a full listing of what all those were, and that's actually been, that's pretty typical of accounts from the 1800s of people's vineyards. They'll say so-and-so was growing 20 varieties, and then they just name three. What we do know he was growing was Pinot Meunier, which is a close relative of Pinot Noir. It's most widely grown in Champagne District. Your typical French Champagne is usually about a third Pinot Noir, a third Pinot Meunier, and a third Chardonnay. So he was growing that. He was growing several varieties of a Swiss grape known as Chasselas. It's a cool weather variety like Pinot Noir. It's rather mild flavored, but the Swiss like it because it goes well with the mild flavored fish that they get out of their cold lakes. He was growing something known as Black Hamburg, which is kind of a tricky name because that name has also been applied to a grape that was created by crossing Black Hamburg with Muscat. The parent grape originates in Italy. It's called Schiava Grosso. In Germany, it's known as Trollinger, and in England, it was called Black Hamburg. And as I say, you may have heard of a grape called Black Muscat, and Black Muscat was created in 1850 by crossing Schiava Grossa with Muscat of Alexandra. He would have had some familiarity with it because they were growing it, as I say, in the Rhineland. He would have known it as Trollinger. So he put in some of that, and he was growing Riesling. As for what the other 45 varieties were, I will probably never know, but I suspect that the ones I named were his mainstays.
It seems like one of the mistakes we make in trying to use the thinking of our time and apply it to an earlier time is to think that people would think in terms of a first vineyard and a first varietal. But the fact is that that making wine just for your own use was pretty typical when white settlement was taking place in Oregon, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. The thing is that they were probably making wine from pretty much anything they could get. Until 1847, the only grapevines that were available in Oregon were derived from grapes that had been planted at Fort Vancouver out there on the Washington side. That was some sort of table grape that had been planted in the late 1820s, and no one knows exactly what it was. The vines were pulled up many decades ago, so no one knows quite what they were. Those, as I say, were table grapes, which in most cases don't make very good wine. There is a claim that there were people at the fort making wine from wintergreen, which is a type of wild berry. They were probably making wine from blackberries and who knows what. The first decent wine grapes that were brought in by Henderson Llewellyn in 1847. He came across on a wagon train and started out with 700 cuttings of not just grapevines, fruit trees, nut trees, various types of horticultural type plants. And he lost about half of them along the way. About 350 or so were viable when they got here. But two of what he brought was Catawba and Isabella, which were both Vitis vinifera and Vitis labrusca hybrids. He established a nursery and started selling vines. So a lot of people were probably planting those two hybrid grapes and making small quantities of wine on their own.
We're talking again with Scott Stursa here on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Oregon Wine, A Deep-Rooted History. I wanted to ask, you mentioned one of the three people who, one from Southern Oregon, who had a major role in early wine in Oregon. Peter Britt, I assume, is the person you're talking about in Jackson County?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what was he making?
Well, initially, he was making Mission. Mission was a grape that had been in the New World probably longer than any other grape. It was being grown by the Franciscan missionaries in South America and Mexico. And when they started establishing a mission chain in California in the late 1700s, early 1800s, they brought the grape along with them. Mission has been identified with DNA testing in the modern era as actually being a grape used in Spain as a sherry grape. As for table wine, it's really not your best choice. But I suppose if you're a Franciscan missionary in the middle of nowhere in early California and it's all you've got to drink, then it's perfectly fine for that.
It'll do.
Del Rio Vineyard down there acquired some acreage in 2016, acquired an old farm, the Bird's Eye Farm, and they found a 160-year-old Mission vine on the property, and they harvested enough grapes off of it in 2016 to make 9 bottles of wine, only to discover it wasn't very good.
Oh, well, at least it was a good, interesting experiment.
But after the railroad connected up with California in 1887, the Brits started bringing in all matter. If you look at his son's notebook that he was keeping track of what they had planted in their vineyard, they brought in 47 different varieties. I mean, all kinds of stuff. Cabernet Sauvignon, Sauvignon Blanc, just Zinfandel, all sorts of grape varieties. And in that list is Franc Pinot, which is one of the alternative names for Pinot Noir. It has more alternative names, in fact, than any other variety of grape.
Any idea why?
Well, partly because it's such an old grape. There's reason to believe that it existed even in Roman times. Its first reference in French literature comes from the 1300s. And even in France, they had a lot of different names for it, and they had different spellings for the word Pinot. And the name was not finalized and made official as Pinot Noir until early in the 20th century. So it went by a lot of different names, and it was partly a matter of where it was being grown. In Switzerland, they call it Blau Burgunder, which translates to Blue Burgundy. So it's kind of hard to pin it down, but Franc Pinot is a name that has never been applied to any other grape than Pinot Noir. So seeing that name in the Brit notebook, you can be reasonably sure that it was Pinot Noir is what they were talking about.
So let's pause for a status check on early Oregon wine. We were talking about how the one of the myths is that not much happened in Oregon wine before 1961. By 1861, several years into white settlement, I mean, was Oregon wine traveling at all, getting any kind of a reputation, good or bad?
Well, 1861 is probably the year that the Matthews Vineyard started bearing fruit, and he would have just been selling locally. He was directly from France and had been in the wine business over there, and he was just following the traditional French pattern of being sort of a local winemaker selling to a local customer base. He was there in French Prairie, where about half the farmers were French or French-Canadian. And so he had a local market for his wine, and that's pretty much all he sold to. Oregon wine didn't start getting any kind of reputation out of the state until the 1890s. As I said, in the late 1880s, Peter Britt started bringing in new varieties and planting them, and he subsequently started marketing his wine fairly aggressively. He had a contract with the Catholic Diocese in Oregon to supply sacramental wine. He had a bottling line, and so he was selling his wine by the bottle and even selling it out of state. Up around Forest Grove, you had the Reuters, a father-son team of Germans, and they were fairly aggressively marketing their wine. They even submitted their wine to three World's Fairs in the 1890s and early 1900s, and won medals in all three of those. Unfortunately, they kind of overplayed that. They actually claimed to have entered wines and won medals in six World's Fairs, but three of them, my research discovered they didn't even enter.
Oh. I noticed that you said the Reuters were the center of one of the most infamous of all the Oregon wine myths, and that would be it, that they claimed.
Well, that's the thing. It kind of goes back to an interview that Ernest Reuter did with a newspaper up there in 1906, and he reeled off a list of world fairs that they had entered and won medals in, and one of them was the St. Louis World's Fair, which they did not enter. And the origin of the myth is two of his sisters, who were still alive in the late 1960s when Charles Curry bought the old Reuter property and started his winery up there. They came around to visit him, and I don't know if they were just perpetuating the falsehood, or they believed it. No one knows, but they told Charles Curry about the medal in the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904, and then Curry repeated that to a couple of authors. Their first books on Pacific Northwest wine were published in 1977. One was a large format book by Elizabeth Purser, and the other one, I forget the author's name. There were two of them, but the name of the book was Pacific Northwest, Wine Trails of the Pacific Northwest. And both of these authors had visited Curry, and he repeated the story of the Reuters silver medal in the 1904 World's Fair for their Riesling. Now, over the years, that has morphed into a gold medal for Pinot Blanc, which is not listed as one of the grapes they were growing. So it's a myth that kind of grew in the telling.
Absolutely.
And like I say, the irony of it is that St. Louis World's Fair in 1904 is one of the ones that they didn't, in fact, even enter.
Scott Stursa, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of Oregon Wine, A Deep-Rooted History. If you want to compare some notes on Oregon wine history, ask some questions, join our conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Scott, you say in the book that Oregon winemaking peaked between 1890 and 1904. How did the production then compare with what's coming out of Oregon vineyards today?
Well, it was considerably less. Keep in mind that the state's population at that time was about one-tenth of what it was today. The actual production values are kind of hard to nail down. Commencing in 1900, the Census Bureau, which was doing not just population census, they were also doing agricultural census and manufacturing census. And up until the 1900 census, they were putting all wine production on the agricultural schedules. But commencing in 1900, they differentiated between what they called farm production and winery production. And I couldn't get a definition of what the difference in those two were, what constituted a commercial winery. And no one at the IRS at this point in time in the 21st century had any idea either. Those records are long gone. In 1900, Oregon produced 20,000 gallons of farm-produced wine. But we don't have the information on what was produced in anything in Oregon that might have been legally defined as a commercial winery. So I think probably 30,000 gallons in 1900 was probably about what was produced and put up for sale. That may be low, but I'm trying to keep it at a conservative estimate. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe the equivalent of two typical Oregon wineries today, most of which are fairly small. But again, you have to remember that the population of the state was only one-tenth of what it is. So on a per capita basis, that would be sort of the equivalent of 30 modern Oregon wineries. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there were places where there was fairly high production locally. If you look at the 1880 statistics down there in Jackson County, you had 15,000 gallons of wine were produced in 1880. Well, there were only 8,000 people in Jackson County in 1880, so that works out to almost 2 gallons for every man, woman, and child in the county, which is a lot of wine.
That is indeed. I wanted to ask about what, you know, we mentioned the peak 1890 to 1904 of that early production, but then in the next decade, Prohibition. What happened to the vineyards in Oregon when booze was illegal?
Well, the Reuters pulled up their vines and planted potatoes and apple trees. The Brits, Emil Britt, who took over when Peter Britt died in 1905, was not interested in continuing with the winemaking and just let the vineyard lapse and turn the property over to raising cattle. Some vineyards continued. The Dorners in Douglas County just switched over to selling juice to home winemakers. That's what the Mathiot family up in Marion County was doing. So some of them were doing that. Some of them attempted to just continue to make wine on the sly. Some people got away with that. The Sandaws family out there in near the Dalles was able to sell wine during Prohibition. Apparently they had an understanding with the local sheriff, who might have been a wine lover himself. whereas Frederick Stettler, Swiss winemaker up near Forest Grove, continued making wine and trying to sell it on the sly, but he was arrested in 1916, and they dumped all 2,000 gallons of his wine.
Guest is the Corvallis-based writer Scott Stursa. Spent 38 years in the information technology business, retired, went into writing full-time, or at least has his major pursuit. He's working in fiction and nonfiction. His second book, after a book about hard spirits in Oregon, is called Oregon Wine, A Deep-Rooted History, which endeavors to explode some of the myths about the Oregon wine industry. It is a lot older than a lot of people give it credit for. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about Prohibition and how some of the vineyards just plowed under and started growing other things. Some people were trying to do the home winemaking loophole and got nailed for that one. There's an interesting perspective you provide in the book, Scott, about consumption of alcoholic beverages during Prohibition. It really sort of changed the character of how we approached alcoholic beverages, you say.
Well, yeah, I mean, particularly for people who were drinking wine, which was largely the immigrants, the Italian Americans, Greek Americans, and so forth, it was just what you drink with your meal. It was no big thing. It was food. And during Prohibition, since you couldn't get it, and people were in a party mood, it was the 1920s after all. Basically it alcohol became essentially a party drug, and it just changed the way everybody thought about alcohol. And it took a long time after Prohibition for the idea of wine as just a beverage you had with your meals to come back into mainstream thinking again.
All right, so really, yeah, much more about getting loaded than just having something to drink with a meal.
Exactly.
A couple of questions from listeners, a couple of observations anyway. The first from Becca in Lane County wants to know how far west in Oregon wine grapes are grown. Are there any near the coast?
I don't know of any vineyards right along the Pacific coast. I know there's some wineries over there, but they get their grapes from inland. So I don't know of any vineyards west of the Coast Range, as in, you know, the west of the drainage basin divides.
Right. I was thinking the Van Duzer Corridor, but as I look at that, it's not that far west of Salem and certainly to the east of the Coast Range.
And the problem is when you get, because I've driven the Van Duzer Corridor from one end to the other, and what happens is once you get up to essentially the pass where the highest altitude, before you start dropping back down towards the coast, is you get a lot of the maritime influences. You get a lot of fog, and grapevines need sunlight, and with the amount of fog that you often get during the day along the coast, you'd have trouble getting enough light. And the other is the temperature. It's always cooler along the coast. I mean, it might be 100 degrees in Jackson County and 90 degrees in the Willamette Valley, and you go out to the coast and it's 65, and that's not enough heat.
Okay, important to know, and thanks for that question, Becca. Then Jeff in Ashland says, prior to moving to Oregon, the only wines that had crossed my radar were Willamette Pinots. The first one that really caught my attention and made me realize there were indeed some great bottles here was Roxy Ann's Claret, made at that time by Gus Janeway, who's now at Velocity Cellars. I've since come to realize how many and varied quality varietals are being made in our backyard. That, again, from Jeff in Ashland. So it is a pretty diverse wine industry now, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, and particularly along the Columbia and down there in southern Oregon, there are some very nice wines being made from warmer climate grapes. I'm sorry to say, I even though I've had some what I thought were okay Pinot Noirs from Southern Oregon. I've not had one that I would characterize as a great wine, matching the best of the Willamette Valley. But on the other hand, with grapes like Tempranillo and Cabernet Franc and Rhone varieties such as Syrah and Grenache, I've had some Southern Oregon wines that were really superlative wines. I believe one should always play to one's strengths, and I think there are too many people in Southern Oregon trying to grow Pinot Noir, and if they really want to establish a reputation for Southern Oregon wine, they should be looking at the varieties of other varieties of grapes. And, you know, there are wineries like Abichella there in Douglas County that don't even grow Pinot Noir. They, again, they're playing to their strength. They know that Tempranillo grows really well there, and so that's what they're growing.
So let's go back in time once again, because we talked about the impact of Prohibition, but World War II put restrictions on fruit growers as well, because a lot of things were rationed and ordered a certain way in the wartime. You point out that there were 22 wineries in the entire state of Oregon as World War II ended. Did the wine industry come close to disappearing at some point?
Well, by about 1960, they were down to 7 bonded wineries in the state. They were all producing fruit wine. Fruit wine is a sort of an industry term for wine not made from grapes. I mean, technically, grapes are fruit, but generally, when you say fruit wine, you mean wine that's made from blackberries or something like that. And until 1961, the point at which the grape wineries outnumbered the fruit wineries actually didn't come until shortly after 1970. And the decline in the number of wineries, I think, can largely be attributed to the fact that over the course of the 1950s, people were gradually starting to take wine seriously again, and so the fruit wines fell out of favor. And so you had declining production and a declining number of wineries making it.
Can you point, Scott, to a time and a place where the modern ascent of the wine industry began, some place that said, you know, let's make some Pinot Noir and get serious about it?
Well, not a specific time and place, and that's a point that I try to make in my book. There, a lot of people love their myths. And they love their heroes, and they like to be able to point to a specific individual like David Lead or someone like that and say, well, this is where it all started. He's the guy, and when he planted his Pinot Noir in near Dundee in 1966, that's where it all started. And I dispute the significance of that. David Lead was a key player in that process. He was the first one, if not the first one, to grow Pinot Noir in the Willamette Valley. He was the first one of the modern era to grow it, and this is really important, make good wine from it. Charles Curry was operating at about the same time. They were operating in parallel. And there's a lot of people who like to argue about which of them was first. These are hair-splitting kind of discussions, but from a historical point of view, they're irrelevant because Charles Curry did not make good wine, but David Lead did. The two of them inspired a number of people to come in, Dick Erath, the Ponzi's. A number of people started coming in the late 60s, 1970s, and started wineries up there in the northern Willamette, mostly around the Dundee area. And they were all making good wine, and they soon established a reputation for Pinot Noir in Oregon. And that's essentially how it started. And it was a group effort. David Lett was very critical to it. Another thing that happened was Bill Blosser of so-called Blosser Winery had a graduate degree in urban and regional planning. So he became involved in the effort to preserve the agricultural status of a lot of potential vineyard land. You had David Adelsheim, who was a real activist and mover and shaker and was instrumental in things like getting the labeling laws changed. So it was not a specific place, but I would say a region, the Northern Willamette. It was not a specific person, but it was a fairly short list, maybe a 10 or a dozen winemakers who got the whole thing started.
Was there a lot of trial and error in modern Oregon winemaking, Scott? Did you find a fair number of examples of people trying to grow grapes that weren't suited to the climate or just didn't make very good wine? I think you just answered the second one already.
Yeah, a number of people tried stuff that just wasn't suited to the area. There were a number of people trying to grow Zinfandel here in the Willamette Valley. It doesn't ripen well, so they quit doing that. But at least in the modern era, the decisions about what to grow were pretty much driven by the climate. I mean, the reason David Lett and Charles Curry came up here in the mid-60s was because they believed that the best grapes were ones that were grown in a climate that allowed them to just reach maturity, but no longer than that. And Charles Curry actually did his master's thesis on that point. So they came to Oregon planning to grow the types of grapes that they felt would work well in the Oregon climate, and for the most part, they were correct about that.
Which raises a question about how varietals might be switching around now as the climate gets fairly consistently warmer in Oregon.
Yes. There's probably going to be a lot of changes over the next 30 to 40 years. They will probably keep trying to grow Pinot Noir here for as long as they can. But if you look at projections done by, are you familiar with Gregory Jones?
Yes, yeah, I've interviewed him.
Yeah, if you look at the projections he's made, there's going to be significant changes in the climate patterns in what we call Region 1, which is ideal for Pinot Noir. In 30, 40 years, unless something drastic changes with the climate change, which I don't think is going to happen, the only places in the Willamette Valley that you're going to be able to grow Pinot Noir well are sort of around the rim at higher altitudes, the foothills of the Cascades and the Coast Range. Down in the valley, it's going to be too warm. And if you want to make grape, you're going to have to go to warmer weather varieties.
Mm-hmm. Greg Jones, by the way, left Southern Oregon University, moved to Linfield College last year. About 2 minutes left here, Scott. I just want to ask about a breakthrough moment for Oregon wines outside the state. I mean, people were certainly getting enthusiastic within Oregon as the Pinots were taking off. But was there I guess I'm asking for another origin story. Here we go again. Was there a particular event or series of events that seemed to solidify Oregon as a place where wine was happening?
Well, I'd say a series of events. I think it started when one of David Lett's Pinot Noirs came in second in a big competition in France in 1980. The following year, Pinot Noir and a Chardonnay from Tulatin Valley Vineyards, so it was started by Bill Fuller, won Best of Show at a big wine competition in London. This got the attention of the wine press, and you had people like Frank Prial, who was a wine columnist for the New York Times, started looking at Oregon wine and trying it. I talk about this in one of the chapters of the book. There was, as I say, a number of competitions where Oregon wines were shown to be as good, if not better, than the best Burgundies. And over the course of the 1980s, Oregon began to establish a reputation for producing good Prial, and it was kind of, if you want to call a significant point where you say it was Oregon had arrived, so to speak, it was probably in 1988 when Frank Prial was doing an article on Oregon Pinot Noir in his column, and he was talking about the fact that Robert Druin, the big French producer of Burgundy had just bought 100 acres near Dundee to start a winery. He states in his article, Oregon, many wine experts agree, consistently produces the finest Pinot Noir in the United States. And that was kind of it.
That is the high praise. Okay, that is that brings us more or less up to date with Oregon wine, a deep-rooted history. Scott Sturza in Corvallis wrote the book and joined us today on The Exchange. Scott, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.